Bill, are you ready to proceed, Ms. Butko?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm prepared.
All right, please proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. At the end of the day, the position that is taken by Mr. Gonzalez is that he wins. Because at the end of the day, application of 34.810.1A doesn't apply to this case. Mr. Gonzalez, in his petition, alleged that his plea was coerced. He alleged that his plea was not knowing and voluntary. And those issues get him to an evidentiary hearing, and those issues are not procedurally barred by 34.810.1A. There were other issues raised in the petition we'll go through. But to begin with, in this particular case, there was a plea bargain. That plea bargain was duly noted in the guilty plea agreement, and it was as follows. The parties are free to argue on the term of the sentence, but the state will recommend the sentences on the three separate counts run concurrently. It's very clean. At the entry of plea, Judge Montero simply put on the record that the parties are free to argue at sentencing. He did not put on the record the second line of the plea agreement and its terms. In the pre-sentence report, also relayed the plea agreement as the parties are free to argue. It neglected to comment that concurrent sentences would be affirmatively recommended by the state. We get to the plea hearing. The defense attorney does not clarify the record and put an accurate plea on the record. The attorney at sentencing does not correct the pre-sentence report to include the fact that the terms should be concurrently recommended by the state. Then we go to sentencing. And at the sentencing hearing, Kevin Pasquale, who I've known for 20 years, is a decent man, argues for the recommendation of the pre-sentence report. The pre-sentence report recommends that two of the terms run consecutively and one of the terms run concurrently. This is not the terms of the plea bargain. Inadvertent mistakes happen, but plea bargains are specific performance. The prosecutor is held to an absolute meticulous detail for honoring the terms of a plea bargain, and Mr. Gonzalez has a right to his contractual recitation from the state. It didn't happen. It's quite simple. I'm surprised that this case has had the litigation it had. I simply anticipated a one-paragraph remand for new sentencing or a one-paragraph he gets out of his plea, one or the other. So the question for me, as what I would argue, is the remedy. And Mr. Gonzalez would like to start his case over. He would like out of his guilty plea, and he would like to go back to square one, get his case put together. So the next question for the court becomes the actual application of 34.810.1A to all the other issues in this case. And that is another issue that I have grave concern with. So I went back and read the legislative history, and I know you have as well. This was a time of law in the state of Nevada where post-conviction work and petition work had no rules. There was very little to go on. All of the petitions were filed in either Clark or Carson City, where the person was in custody. And the goal was to unbog their courts. Their courts were literally beat up with petitions because they had the whole state's caseload in their pocket. So when we read the legislative history, the idea was to take the petitions that dealt with prison conditions or jail time counts and put those into where the prison is located and move all the other cases back to the court who imposed the judgment. That was one of the key issues raised when they were passing 34.810.1A in 1985. Also of interest for the court is that 34.810.1A refers to the federal statutes that were in play then, and they were in the 70s version of post-conviction. That was attached as Exhibit D. And when I looked at Exhibit D, I found clearly that there was no discussion of waiving constitutional claims or waiving claims that occurred after entry of plea. So the state's position on this case is that we are waiving claims that have not yet happened. So if we effectively do this, there is no right to effective assistance of counsel at critical stages of the proceedings. We know in our hearts the legislature did not go in that room and say, let's build an unconstitutional law and let's write this. That's not what they did. They didn't mean it. They never saw this statute as possibly inferring that your constitutional rights go out the window if you say you're guilty. Other issues that arise with this attitude and this approach. What happens with an Alford plea? The Alford case was well ahead of the 1985 statute, but it's not mentioned in the statute. No contest pleas existed. They're not mentioned in the statute. That's because the legislature was thinking if someone has come in here, they've admitted their guilt, and they got a mandatory sentence, we don't need to hear from them because they admitted they were guilty and the judge had no choice but to give them the sentence, like in a lewdness case. But on other cases, counsel has an obligation to be effective at sentencing. That has stood since the 70s, and there's no way we should backtrack on that. The state's position on this case is actually asking this court to undo rights our citizens have and tell them go to the federal court and look for help. That's not an answer. That's not a solution. That's problematic. So when we look at this case, we know that on the date of sentencing, this attorney did not raise the plea bargain, which was beneficial to his client. He didn't even argue it. He had to argue for the plea bargain. That's why cases settle. 94-95% of our state court cases settle by plea. And they do that because we trust in our lawyers, we trust in our judges to respect the fact that we worked hard to get a good plea bargain resolution for our client. But if the court doesn't know we have that plea bargain resolution for our client, how can the court even start to assess it? So Judge Montero, when he took the plea, thought it was a free-to-argue case. The pre-sentence report says it's a free-to-argue case. The party stood up at sentencing and free-to-argued, and at no point did this attorney say, Judge, by the way, the state has agreed to recommend concurrent sentences, and that is because my client is pleading to a crime he did not commit. He's pleading to a higher crime than he committed. So because he's pleading to a crime he did not legally commit, he should get the benefit of the bargain, and the sentences should run concurrently. Also, he could have argued very simply that the phone messages to two of the victims were on one phone, even though they're not redundant because two people received the messages. They happened at the same time. They're exactly the same offense, so concurrent time is appropriate. And that makes sense as to why the pre-sentence report recommended concurrent time. But none of that happened, and that's the problem. Then we go to the very next step of the case. The next step of the case is the direct appeal. We all know that appeals are for litigating breaches of plea bargains. That is a proper appellate issue. That was not raised on this direct appeal, and Mr. Gonzalez has a right to effective assistance of counsel on direct appeal. And even if he pled and got sentenced, he can still appeal. He has an absolute right to counsel on his direct appeal, and that counsel must be effective. We have long-term standing Nevada cases this court will be forced to overrule if this court applies NRS 34-810-1A in the manner suggested by the state. So what happens?
Ms. Butko, may I interrupt you for a moment, please, ma'am? Yes. This is Justice Herndon in Las Vegas.
Hi, Justice Herndon.
My recollection of your petition, since you focused several times on 34.810, your petition didn't focus just on that particular statute. My recollection is it referenced the entire sequence of Chapter 34, correct?
Correct. And it raised everything in a constitutional manner.
Well, which would encompass the earlier 34724, which allows defendants who have been imprisoned to challenge not just their plea, but the sentence that was imposed if it's violative of the Constitution by way of habeas corpus relief as well, correct?
Correct.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. So what I see when I look at this question of how 34-810-1A is going to be applied is I see that we're setting up different classes of defendants, and that's simply wrong. It's a violation of due process. So if you enter a plea, you're treated differently than a person who went to jury trial. Why? You should still have a right to counsel performing at sentencing at a high standard of care. This court has been very active in improving the quality of defense work in the state of Nevada, and I'm proud of that. This court has assisted building a new division, Nevada Division of Indigent Defense Services, to oversee people and make sure that we are providing the quality of care that is expected in our state. Adopting 34-810-1A, as suggested by the judge and as suggested by the state, sets us backwards. It does not bring us to our end goal, which is to provide good quality legal work for indigent defendants. The other concern that I really have is the possibility that this court would send pro se defendants to the federal court as a matter of first resort. All of the standing case authority we have says the federal courts really want to exercise deference to our state court positions. If we don't have hearings and we don't have pleadings in state court, we go straight to federal court. That court is now the court of first resort instead of the court of last resort. Federal case after federal case grants deference to our state court judges and their rulings. There will be no rulings to grant deference to, which means Nevada will no longer control how Nevada interprets its laws. The federal court system will. I personally, as a Nevadan, don't want to give up those rights. These are things our judges do. They know what's right in our communities. They know how to handle law in our communities. So I would urge you not to send petitioners to the federal court if they have constitutional claims. Let them bring them in a duly filed state court petition, as the practice has been. The other thing I want to point out is we know that this statute didn't intend this consequence, because up until 1991, a person could appeal all of the issues that they entered a plea upon. It was in 1991 that 1740353 was amended to say that if you have pled guilty, you specifically have to reserve the right to argue pre-plea issues on appeal. This is the same concept. We're asking defendants to waive issues that have not yet occurred. As a practitioner in this field, my ethics are called into question, because my ethics are higher than this. You're asking me to tell a person to plead guilty, and you may be giving up your right to whether I do a good job at sentencing. You may give up your rights to issues that arise. You may give up your right to effective assistance of counsel on appeal by application of this statute in this manner. I, as an attorney, would have to sit down, put that in writing. Then perhaps I need a second attorney to give my client advice as to whether I'm giving them the right advice. We are going down a dark tunnel, creating more litigation by applying this law in the manner suggested by Judge Montero and the state. We simply can't do it. So we do have standing law that says I can't have a client waive effective assistance of counsel in a guilty plea. That's Hood v. State. That's been standing law for nigh on 20 years. Why are we going to say today is different? I can tell my client, okay, well, I'm just going to show up at your sentencing and I'm going to be that potted plant. I'm not going to say a word. That cannot be the status of our representation in Nevada. So also of interest to me, and I couldn't decide how to frame the argument, is that the statute uses the word petition. 34.810.1a talks about petition. Doesn't talk about claims. So if we file a petition to meet the mandates of 34.810.1a and put in that our client wants to withdraw from a plea that he doesn't want to withdraw from, he really wants his sentencing issues heard, he really wants to argue his appeal was not handled properly. But we put that in there just to say, okay, I got to put that in there in order to get into court. That makes no sense. You're asking people to put in claims they're not interested in and litigate issues they don't want. Could also put them in harm's way, because what if the state said, yeah, I never did like that plea bargain, I'm going to let him out. And really all he wanted was someone to look at his sentencing proceeding. So I would urge the court not to follow this case. I've listed for you in my brief the cases that would have to be overruled if we're going to do 34.810.1a in this manner. And just to remind you, we're going to start with Hood. That goes away. Weaver v. Warden goes away. Kirksey goes away. Lara goes away. We don't have a reason to do this. Cost effective, it will not be, because what we will have is an attorney general's office who's going to probably have to hire 10 new deputies. We're going to shift the cost out of the state court budgets into the attorney general's office, and they're going to have to defend these actions for first run in federal court. That's not a good approach to Nevada law. And we need to keep our constitution in play for us to take care of. The problematic consequences of removing every state court post-conviction to federal court just can't be understated to this court. So I think that you've seen the number of cases I have pending up there. I've noted them in my routing statement, and they're all impacted by this case. So I am very hopeful that when you review this case, you do so with an eye on the five or six that I have that are up there already. There's more coming, because what's going to happen now is all post-conviction habeas cases are going to get a one-liner out of the district courts. They're going to clear their caseload. I pointed you to two jury trial cases that had dismissal issues based on 34.810.1a. They went to jury trial. It doesn't apply. One, the judge threw the entire case out with a one-paragraph ruling. I urge you not to adopt this law in this manner. I urge you to keep our Nevada state courts involved in our post-conviction process. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Henderson?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Elise Henderson, and I'm here on behalf of Nevada Attorneys for Criminal Justice. As Ms. Butko pointed out, around 95% of criminal defendants in Nevada plead guilty. This court regularly considers in habeas proceedings claims of constitutional deprivations occurring after those guilty pleas. This continued unchanged after the enactment of 810-1A, and this approach is the approach most consistent with the legislative intent, the state constitution, and the statutory scheme as a whole. Starting with the legislative intent, in addition to what Ms. Butko pointed out, 810-1A was not a controversial provision. It passed unanimously with the support of public defenders in Nevada. What would have been controversial is if the legislature had taken a dramatically different approach to what was happening in federal courts at the time and what was happening in this court at the time. In 1970, this court said that a plea changes how a petitioner can raise claims that happened before the plea, but said nothing about claims that happened after the plea. The same in the federal courts, which the legislature was attempting to codify in 810-1A. If the legislature had proposed instead and discussed in the legislative history barring post-plea claims, that would have been present in the legislative history. It is nowhere in there. And what the legislature would have been doing is proposing an unconstitutional law. It's unconstitutional because the state constitution enshrines the right to petition for habeas relief. It also protects the rights, including the right to effective assistance of counsel at sentencing and on appeal. The legislature cannot suspend that right. It can only impose reasonable regulations like a one-year time limit or a successive bar. Depriving the vast majority of criminal defendants in Nevada of the right to seek vindication of constitutional violations after a guilty plea is a substantive deprivation of the writ. It's not a regulation. And as Justice Herndon pointed out, the interpretation urged by the state here is inconsistent with the statutory scheme as a whole, which explicitly provides for challenges to sentences, not just challenges to convictions. And there are just a couple of other areas that I wanted to expand on very quickly. For the state's argument that petitioners in Nevada can just go to federal court, in addition to what Ms. Butko argued, federal courts are not a substitute for state courts because federal courts have no role at all in interpreting and applying state constitutional law. So removing the state forum for those cases is depriving criminal defendants in Nevada of any forum for arguing state constitutional violations. It also elevates the federal courts over the state courts in a way that nobody in the state legislature or the federal legislature intended with the habeas scheme that's set up. The state courts are supposed to have the first opportunity to interpret and apply federal constitutional law for Nevada defendants. But adopting the state's interpretation makes the federal courts, in effect, a direct appeal court over the state courts. And just one final point. Ms. Butko pointed out that there is some ambiguity in the language about petitions versus claims and what must be dismissed and what can remain. The statute is ambiguous for the reasons in the amicus brief, but this court doesn't actually have to decide that question to decide this case, because this court can look at what the legislature clearly intended And what the legislature clearly intended was not to create an unconstitutional law and not to cause the effects that the state is arguing for here. If there are no questions, we ask this court to continue interpreting 810-1A in a way consistent with the legislative history, statutory scheme, and Constitution. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Henderson. Mr. Gordon, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, Ms. Butko, Ms. Emerson, I believe. My name is Anthony Gordon. I'm a deputy district attorney in Humboldt County, Nevada. I represent the county and the state of Nevada in this instance. Initially, I'd like to point out that the defendant in this case, Mr. Melvin Gonzalez, did have an evidentiary hearing in the district court. The district court, in addition to citing 34-810-1A, also found on a lot of the other claims, as the Court of Appeals had initially pointed out, that the claims had lacked merit.
Mr. Gordon, I have a question.
Yes.
This goes to the underlying facts. The appellant had just made a statement that in the plea agreement, the state was to affirmatively recommend a certain sentence. I recognize when I read your briefs that it's a little unclear to me, but did the state actually affirmatively recommend what it said it was going to do from the plea bargain at sentencing?
Well, the state takes a position it does, as well as the trial counsel was able to testify at the evidentiary hearing, and
I saw that. I did see that, and I saw he was not clear on it. My question to you is, it's very clear, did you affirmatively recommend to the district court what you said you were going to recommend? It's either a yes or a no. It's just, what did you do? I'm not asking what did
well,
you do.
What Mr.
Did you follow the plea agreement? And did you affirmatively recommend the sentence that you said you were going to recommend in the plea bargain?
Mr. Pasquale, who was the attorney from our office at the sentencing, believes he did. I believe he did. I mean, it's Mrs. Butko takes the alternate argument, but that I believe he did, and Mr. Cochran believes he did. It's I agree to the court. There's an ambiguity in there, but the district court found that it lacked merit, and there was evidence to the contrary in the record. The main issue that
Mr. Gordon, are you saying that? I'm sorry, it's Justice Kadish and Carson.
Oh, I'm. Go ahead.
Are you saying that Judge Montero found that the guilty plea agreement was complied with? Because I missed that in the order, so I want to find it if that's what
okay,
he said.
It's my understanding, and I have to go back and look. It's my understanding that argument was raised. The defense of the trial attorney didn't think there was a plea agreement. Mm-hmm. Mr. Pasquale didn't think there was a breach. I mean, Mr. Cochran didn't think there was a breach. Mr. Pasquale didn't think there was a breach. I believe the way the court addressed it, looking at it now, that the court addressed it through 34-810-1A.
Okay, thank you.
And I think that's if I had misspoken. But that's the issue that we're here today. I think both Mrs. Henderson and Mrs. Butko, what we have here is a statute, 34-810-1A, and I know the court has set aside the Court of Appeals opinion on it, but the reasoning is very sound. The issue that we have, the issue that the appellant and others seek to decide in this case, is basically a legislative remedy, if the legislature even decides to take that up. It's clear on the face of the statute what the Nevada legislature determined by 34-810-1. The Court of Appeals laid out
Mr. Gordon, let me interrupt you if I may, sir. This is Justice Herndon in Las Vegas, and I apologize. But
no problem.
I don't know that there's great quarrel
with 34.810 saying what it says, that if a petition is filed and the basis of that petition is challenging the plea, that it has to contain certain things. How does that, in your mind, however, coexist in harmony with 34.724, which says someone who is imprisoned and who claims that their sentence was imposed in violation of the Constitution can file for habeas corpus relief? Because I'm sure you would concede, since it's been, I mean, McMahon 50 years ago in the United States Supreme Court, it's not just assistance of counsel, it's effective assistance of counsel that's constitutionally guaranteed. And if you don't receive that at sentencing, it's a violation of the Constitution. So how can you harmonize those two statutes and take the position that no petition could be filed to challenge a sentencing problem with the attorney?
The way I think it could be harmonized is the legislature, as the Court of Appeals noted, as well as the federal law on this issue, there's no constitutional right to post-conviction review.
Mr. Gordon, I have a question. Mr. Gordon, Justice Silver again?
Yes.
So to follow up on what I asked, hypothetically speaking, if we take what Ms. Bucco argued to us, and let's hypothetically say in this situation that somebody pleads and then the state says we will affirmatively recommend probation, and then at sentencing after a plea, the state stands up and asks for the maximum punishment under law. Your interpretation is that this petitioner, after they're sentenced to the maximum time per the state's argument, that they have no remedy with post-conviction based on a breach. I mean, is that what you're saying here? Because the legislature, you're saying, didn't provide for it.
No, I'm saying they have a right. If the state breaches the plea agreement, not only is there ethical ramifications for the state's attorney, but it could be appealed on direct appeal, as well as, I believe, can be challenged in the district court for a resentencing and enforcement of the plea agreement.
Well, what if the defense attorney doesn't object at the direct appeal level and didn't object?
Well,
I'm going to post-conviction is what I'm saying.
No,
ineffective assistance.
Well, I think there's Nevada, there's a statute that they can go in there and argue that the sentence was illegal. There's remedies in which they can get back in the district court to argue that the state did not abide by the terms of the plea agreement. I think the issue here is, the state has not taken the position. Obviously the state agrees that the defendant is entitled to a effective assistance of counsel at the trial stage, at the sentencing stage, at the appellant stage. The issue here is, where is that remedy? Where can they seek redress if they believe it's a violation? And as the Court of Appeals pointed out, the federal courts are open for them to for the defendant to seek redress in the federal court.
Sir, this is Justice Kadish. Are you familiar with the limitations on the habeas remedy placed under the AEDPA law in the federal court?
I'm aware generally about them. Yes, Your Honor.
Right. And so, you know, the federal court is limited, and they're only supposed to be getting involved if the state court has made an unreasonable interpretation of the rights of the defendant. I'm no expert on it, but do you understand generally that's what it says?
That's what I understand, yes.
And, okay, now the federal court would not be addressing any state constitutional right to effective assistance of counsel, correct?
Well, they, in a sense that you would be able to, in the sense that the defendant would be able to allege the effective assistance of counsel under Strickland, I think you would have the ability to go into federal court. Because not only do you have a state violation, you would have actually a federal violation if a defense attorney was practicing in an ineffective manner under Strickland.
And, sir, just one more question at this point. Have you read the amicus brief submitted by the State Attorney General's office?
Yes, I have.
And I read that as taking a different point of view than you are as to this statute. Can you address their argument and why you disagree?
Well, their argument is, and basically in regards to, their concern was footnote 3 on page 12 of the Court of Appeals opinion, that you would not have a sufficient record in the state court, so when the matter goes into federal court, the federal court would be looking at these issues anew. They wouldn't have a district court reviewing these decisions beforehand.
But I think the issue is really,
since the defendant doesn't have a constitutional right, federal constitutional right to habeas, the issue is, where is the remedy addressed? And I think the legislature, by the clear, unambiguous wording of 34.810, laid out what the scope of the habeas corpus was on a post-conviction, and it's up to the legislature if the attorney general's office or if the attorneys for the criminal justice or Ms. Butko, if there's a argument that they want to expand the scope, the issue is not for this court to do so.
This is Justice Stiglitz. This court's repeatedly entertained habeas petitions that allege ineffective assistance of counsel at sentencing after a guilty plea.
That's correct.
How do you distinguish Weaver? How do you distinguish Wilson? How do you indicate to this defendant that he has no remedy in state court when we've repeatedly upheld that right?
Well, I don't, Your Honor. I go back. There's prior, and even I was looking at a Webb case where this issue has come up before. And as I pointed out in my brief, there's other non-published opinions where the court has indicated that,
Sir, I looked at your list of cases and the unpublished cases, and it regurgitates the language of 34.810, but the factual context for those cases are for issues that arrived pre-plea, that address the plea and the entry of the plea. Can you direct me to a case where we have denied a defendant effective assistance of counsel at sentencing?
Well, I'm not saying the court. I'm looking at Webb v. State, which is 538 P2 164, where the court in that case talked about the guilty plea represents a break in the chain of events. I think the issue is the defendant obviously has a right of effective assistance of counsel at the sentencing as well as the appellate stage. But the scope of that right is clearly within the legislature to determine. We have a statute here, 34.810A, that it's clear on its face what it says. And I think 8101A, it's clear on its face what it says. It limits it to this, the voluntariness of the plea or the ineffective assistance of counsel surrounding the plea. As a Court of Appeals noted, these claims were not abrogating the defendant's right to the effective assistance of counsel at sentencing or on appeal.
Well, it's then just what's all the remedy? Then, sir, what's the remedy if it's violated?
Well, the remedy would either go back to, the remedy right now would go into federal court. And I think that's what the legislature did by the way it wrote that statute.
Mr. Gordon, this is Justice Hardesty.
Yes, Judge.
In the Court of Appeals opinion, they state very clearly that this statute, 34.810.1A, precludes a review of the sentencing hearing And what's troubling to me is whether or not, as Justice Herndon has raised earlier and others, was NRS 34.724 argued to Justice Judge Montero, or was it argued to the Court of Appeals when this matter was being decided by those two courts?
I don't recall. I didn't do the sentencing, but my review of the record, I don't recall that statute specifically being argued.
Okay.
I can leave it to Mr. Spetko.
I'm gonna ask her.
That's fine.
But my question is this, though, with respect to that statute, you've heard Justice Herndon refer to it and other justices, and you've been asked to reconcile that statutory remedy against the Court of Appeals decision. Isn't one of the problems here that this statute wasn't presented to the Court of Appeals and wasn't argued to them?
Well, I mean, I'm not where it is. I mean, there's an argument that could be that this issue is still not ripe for this court to resolve. I think the legislature had the authority to put limits on habeas as it sees fit in order to give finality to a guilty pleas versus the rights of somebody in an incarcerated setting. I'm not aware of it being raised. One final thing that I'd like to indicate, a lot of the cases Ms. Butko cites in her brief, Polson and Ropella, all those cases deal with 8101B. Those are cases which they're either they're found guilty by jury trial, or there's a sentencing on a capital case where there's a jury decides. We're not talking about all those cases she cites, Doyle, all those deal with fall under a different part of 34810. They fall under 1B instead of 1A. I think 1A, we're only dealing with issues dealing with the plea, and I don't think those cases are applicable. One final issue.
Mr. Gordon, I'm sorry, Justice Stiglitz again. I don't want to talk about a case you cited because you directed this court to Webb, which was the 538P2164, and that specifically says you basically can't attack situations and facts preceding the plea. I'm going to ask you again, how do you distinguish Weaver and Wilson v. State, which are two rulings of this court that say we can address ineffective assistance of counsel at sentencing after a guilty plea? And with respect to the cases Ms. Butko was citing, there's a difference between a trial and a sentencing in front of a jury and then after that can be addressed on appeal. Here, you're suggesting that with a guilty plea, that person has no right to effective assistance of counsel after or to this court's review. So how do you reconcile those pieces?
Your Honor, I understand where you're going on it. I read a lot of these cases. The issue is that the way we see it is we're just dealing with the legislature's interpretation of 34A101A. And I think it's constitutional based on the authority that the legislature had. So, I think it's difficult, but I think the issue is, there's a remedy for ineffective assistance of counsel at the sentencing, at the appellate stage. The remedy would go into federal court. That's what the legislature intended here.
Then your position is the legislature intended to overrule Weaver and Wilson and take away the power of this court to review effective assistance of counsel at a sentencing.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that I understand there's the inconsistency, but I'm just looking at the legislature had the power to do what it had to do in the way it enacted 34 810A. The remedy for a defendant would be in federal court. We're not denying the right. I mean, Ms. Henderson argued that we're taking away the right and we're denying the habeas corpus. We're not. The legislature is not doing that. The legislature is saying this is the scope that we've determined, and all the way back to, as the Court of Appeals pointed out, back to 1985.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gordon. I think we understand your position. Ms. Butko, I don't believe you reserve time, but I do want to ask the question that I posed to you earlier, or posed to your opponent. Did the parties call to the attention of the district court or the Court of Appeals NRS 34-724?
Your Honor, not only did the state not bring 34-724 to the attention of Judge Montero, 34-810-1A was never argued in any document. Judge Montero brought that himself to the party when he issued his order. It was nowhere in play in any pleading at all.
So my question is, did you?
I did not. I did not see 34-810 even coming at me, because I simply never thought it would be applied in this manner. So I was asleep at the wheel. I blame me.
Well, no, this is not a matter of trying to seek blame. I'm just trying to determine what the Court of Appeals had in front of it when it proceeded with its per curiam opinion. All right. Thank you, Ms. Butko. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Question. Sorry, Chief. Can I just clarify, Ms. Butko? I think you just said you hadn't raised these issues in the district court. Had you raised the interplay of 724 or 810 in your briefing to this court that the Court of Appeals had before it?
I did not do the interplay. I simply went on constitutional grounds, and I know we have standing law that supports me, so I went with